Good evening. Before we begin with continuing in the Gemara and Ksuvos, as Purim is coming up this week, I just wanted to share with you a thought on the Megillah. When Haman was having his plan come to fruition, Mordechai approached Esther, who was then the queen, and said, "Esther, perhaps you being the queen is fortuitous. This is why you were placed in the palace. This is why God put you in this position, in order that you should be able to go to Ahasuerus and advocate on behalf of our people and bring about salvation in that way. And therefore Mordechai told her, you should go to the king and request an audience and tell him." And Esther responded to Mordechai, "It's been a while since Ahasuerus has called me. I will in fact go. But a person is not allowed to go in front of the king without being called. And why should I risk that when it's likely that Ahasuerus is going to call me any day now?" And Mordechai wrote back a rather scathing reply. He said, "Why should you delay? Why are you so concerned about your own life? If you do not do this and go forth to Ahasuerus, salvation will come to the Jews from some other place. And you and your father's house, you and your family will perish." Strongly saying, driving home the message, now is not a time to delay. Now is the time for action. We have a plan, we have an idea, we have something that we know we can do. And of course, they knew that Hashem was ultimately the source of their salvation, but they felt that this was their ishtadlus, and their ishtadlus was not to delay. Mordechai felt it had to be done right away. So it's a little hard to understand. The Maharal asks, why did Mordechai feel it was so imperative to go so fast? On the surface of it, it would seem that Esther's response was a pretty reasonable one. "I'm absolutely planning on going to the king and requesting that he save the Jews. However, he hasn't called me in a while. Why should I put myself out there when I know he's likely to call me?" And just strategically, Esther's position was a pretty strong one. A person who goes to the king when they're not called and then requests something is that much more likely to have their request refused. If Esther waits for Ahasuerus to call her, and then after being called she puts forth her request, it's that much more likely that the king's going to be in the mood to listen to Esther's request and to grant it. So, what exactly was Mordechai's response? And it seems that Mordechai realized that despite the fact that Esther had some cheshbonos, why she thought it made sense to wait, ultimately this was not something that could be delayed, not something that could be pushed off. It had to be done right away. However, the Rishiva, later Rishiva of Chofetz Chaim, of Henoch Leibowitz, Zatzal, asked the following question. If Mordechai was responding to Esther that, "Esther, I know you feel it makes sense to delay, but it doesn't. Now is the time for action. Now is not a time to delay. If we have an idea, we have to simply hurry and carry it through." So then Mordechai's response doesn't seem to make any sense. If we look in the Megillah, the words that Mordechai says are, "Why are you so concerned about your life? If you're so concerned at a time like this, when the Jews need you, salvation will come to the Jews from somewhere else, and you and your father's house will perish." If they were having a strategic argument, an argument about what really made the most sense, what tactic made the most sense to approach Ahasuerus, so why didn't Mordechai simply say, "I think it makes more sense to hurry, now is not a time to delay"? Why even mention Esther's concern about her own life? And the Rishiva answered that it must be that Mordechai realized that although Esther was concerned about the strategy that they were employing and felt, and perhaps reasonably, that it made sense to wait, Mordechai realized that her, not reason, but her motive for taking that position was not simply because she felt that was the best strategy for approaching Ahasuerus. Rather, it was because on some level, there was a part of her that although she was ready to give up her life for her people, there was a part of her that was a little bit afraid to do so. And that part of her, somewhat deep buried in her subconscious, although she herself may not have realized it, that part of her gave her hesitancy. And as a result of that, she came to the conclusion, you know what, maybe it makes more sense to wait. And so Mordechai responded to that motive, that negiah, that bias. And Mordechai said, you're acting this way because you're concerned for your life. Now is not a time to concern yourself with your life. It's do or die. We have to give it our all. Now is not a time to hesitate. There's a lot to lose and a lot to gain. So much is on the line, Esther. Now is when we have to hurry. And he spoke very strongly to help her to realize that, and sort of motivated her to say, I also have a lot to gain, and my father's house will die if I don't put this forward, and at the same time I can save the Jewish people if I do. And therefore Mordechai pushed her in that way, and he spoke to her biases, her subconscious, her underlying negias. It's just interesting to think about the fact that Esther, despite the fact that in her own right was a Nevi'ah and was a very, very holy person, certainly capable of making these kind of cheshbonos on her own, although it's possible for Esther and Mordechai to have had a difference of opinion about strategy, what's strange is that Esther was unclear on her own motives. It seems that nevertheless, Esther was in fact unable to fully identify her own motive for wanting to delay. And what's more is that this motive was about saving her own life. It had nothing to do, there was no bias that she had some other reason why she wanted to delay, not for the delay's sake. It wasn't some ulterior motive in terms of the delay. It was that somehow the fact that she had this ulterior motive caused her to come to a different conclusion about what was the best strategy. That's the way our subconscious biases speak to us. Not directly impacting the decision that's in front of us, but indirectly, in a twisting way, in a convoluted manner that causes us to rethink things in a way we wouldn't have otherwise done. And that's what happened with Esther. Even such a holy person, a tzaddikus like Esther, was still able to be fooled by her own subconscious. All that much more so how we have the potential to be fooled by our subconscious. And at the same time, we also have the ability, and we see this from Mordechai's strong response. Mordechai was taking her to task not because she had the negiah, not because she had the bias in the process, because she didn't fully root it out. Mordechai felt it was incumbent upon her to do so, and he felt that it was possible for her to do so. That means that all of us have the ability, in every instance, when we have some kind of a subconscious bias, some kind of a negiah, to root it out, to find it, and to realize that our reason for taking XYZ action is really not because we think it's the right thing, but because we're scared, or it makes us feel better, or some other thing, and it pushes us away from doing the Ratzon Hashem. And if we're able to root out those negiyas, it's one step closer to us being able to do exactly what Hashem wants of us. Just a nice little thought from the Megillah. And with that, let's proceed with Tractate Ksubas. The Gemara in Ksubas says on the top of Yud Amud Aleph, Itmar, it was said, Amar of Nachman, Amar Shmuel, Mishum Rav Shimon ben Elazar. Rav Nachman said the name of Shmuel and the name of Rav Shimon ben Elazar. Chachamim tikni lehem levnas Yisrael uvzula masayim lalmana mana. The Chachamim enacted that Jewish girls should get a specific amount for their marital contract. For Besula, for a virgin, it's 200, and for an almana, it was 100. Now, this is what is known as a Tanai Bezdin, stipulation of the court. In other words, theoretically, a husband and a wife, or a husband and usually a father-in-law, could write a contract which would stipulate that should the marriage dissolve, the husband's obligated to pay 1,000 or 2,000 or whatever number they may come up with. However, in an instance where there no contract, or if, even if a contract was written, because the contract had to be written, but no amount was specified in the contract, this was the sort of fallback position, this was the standard that the courts enacted, that even if no amount is specified, this is the absolute minimum. And they did this in order to make sure that every Jewish girl who entered into a marriage was protected. There's a certain inherent protection in the ksuba, because it gives a security. The husband's not going to be so quick to divorce if he knows the obligations are going to be incumbent upon him after he's no longer married. So then this itmar, this statement goes on to say, V'hein ha'eminuhu, And they believed him. They, the Chachamim, believed the husband. But if he says, after being together with his wife, it was a Pesach Pesuach, and she seems to have not been a virgin, Neman, he's believed. Im Kain, if so, so now the Gemara queries, if that's true, how did the Chachamim help anything with their Takana? In other words, they created this enactment that no matter what is stipulated in the contract, the minimum is either 200 or 400. Excuse me, 200 or 100, depending on whether she's a virgin or not. So, but if the guy always has the opportunity to come in the day after the wedding and say, turns out it was a Pesach Pesuach, then how much did the Chacham really help? That security is greatly lost. As soon as the husband is together with his wife, if he's unhappy for whatever reason, if he's rethinking things at that point, he can then divorce her, and she'll be left a divorcee with nothing. So the Gemara answers, Amar Rava. Rava says, Chazaka ein adam torech pesudam afsida. There's a certain given assumption that a person would not go to such great length to make a whole wedding feast and then lose it, if not for the fact that he was saying the truth, that in fact it was a Pesach Pesuach. Let's take a look at Rashi. Chachom tiknu le'isha v'chulei, tomar, as if to say, ihavai ksubasa d'oraisa, if the marital contract that we're discussing, ksuba, was, and that it has to be 200 or 100, was from the Torah, lo havinam alafkia, he would not be allowed to then divorce her, ela be'edus yadua, unless it was with known testimony that she was not a virgin. But since the ksuba was established by the rabbis, there's a rule that they themselves made the enactment in the first place. They can make whatever rules about the enactment that they want. Those who established it in the first place, amru shehu neman lafsida, these believed even to make her lose that ksuba afbetanis v'safasilch, even with this claim. This is working with the, we had a machlokas in the previous amud, in the previous, really, the previous daf, between Shmuel and Rav Elazar, whether when a man is believed to say Pesach Pesuach, is that to the extent that he causes her to lose out on her ksuba, or is that only to the extent that he creates an isser upon himself, but not to the extent that if he divorces her, he is absolved of his obligation to pay her? According to Rav Elazar, he would still have to pay her even if he's believed to some extent, and according to Shmuel, he's believed enough to get out of that obligation. So this is clearly working with Shmuel, that when we believe him, because the Chachamim were the ones who established this ksuba in the first place, therefore they were the ones who also said, so therefore we believe him. And even though, theoretically, that makes the entire enactment somewhat worthless, the answer is it's not worthless because we have sort of confidence that the man is not going to absolve the marriage if it's not true, after he made all this effort. If he was going to divorce her, if he wasn't really planning on marrying her in the long term, he wouldn't create this whole wedding feast just to divorce her the next day. Unless, in fact, he discovered something that he hadn't known before. Okay, the Gemara then goes on to say, now let's take a look at one more Rashi before we go on. A couple of lines down, Rashi says, Chazaka in Adam Terech Pesud of Chule, Ein Lachosh Sheyitan Adam Kach. Don't be concerned that a man will claim this, Elbanes, unless it's true. If he hated her originally, he would not have gone to all the effort to create a feast, but Konsa and married her, and then lose out on that feast that he created, for no real reason. He would have divorced her in the first place. Okay, that's similar to the way we spoke it out. Rashi spells it out very clearly. Let's take a look at the Gemara further. The Gemara says, Tana hol v'uknas chachamim hu, lo sig be'elam nezivoris. It was taught that since it's a fine of the Chachamim, a kanas of the Chachamim, she only collects from the Ziboris. In other words, since the whole ksuba, her being allowed to collect 200, was an enactment that the rabbis created, and it's not from the Torah, or at least that's the implication, since it's not from the Torah. Therefore, she only collects from what's called Ziboris, which is the lowest quality land. We're going to run into that throughout the page. There's Idis, which is the highest quality land, Beninus, which is the medium quality, and Ziburis, which is the lowest quality. So, the Chachamim cannot create what's called a Shibud, a lien, land any higher than the meanest quality. So the Gemara asks, Kanasa? You're calling, referring to it as a Kanasa, fine? My Kanasa. And Rashi explains, my Kanasa, Kalomar, my Pasha de Kakansinale. What did he do wrong that we're literally fining him? Usually a fine is sort of like, you know, you get a traffic ticket, that's a fine, that's a Kanas. You know, it's not like you owe somebody money and therefore you're paying them back. Kanas implies that a person did something wrong and therefore we're taking money as sort of in order to punish him for doing wrong, and perhaps also it serves as a deterrent so people shouldn't do it in the future. Elo ema, rather you have to say that what was really taught, the way it was said was, hol v'takonas chachamim, since it was a takonas chachamim, lo sig v'elamin ziboris. She can only collect from ziboris. Let's take a look at Rashi, elamin ziboris. Im bas ligbos ksuba. So if she comes to collect her ksuba, meaning her husband, her ex-husband now owes her 200, and again this is 200 zuz, which is a biblical currency. Not biblical, excuse me. Talmudic currency. Currency that was used during the time of the Gemara. V'yeshlo idis v'ziboris, ubanis, and her ex-husband has three levels of land. Eine yechol lomar tenli idis ubanis. She's not able to say, give me idis ubanis, either of those two higher levels of land, b'shavye, in for the worth of 200, meaning a 200 zuz plot of land is going to be different in size depending on the quality of the land. Right? Just a basic rule of value. Idis land, which is the highest quality land, is of course going to be much sold at a premium. A much smaller plot will still cost 200 zuz, whereas Ziboris, which is a more mean quality of land, is much lower quality, is obviously going to be a much larger plot for that same price. So as she continues, Ella imba liten la ziboris peshavya yitin. Rather, if he wants to give her ziboris, that lowest quality, in for the worth of 200 yitin, then he can give it. So this is all according to the idea, the opinion, that ksuba is an enactment of the rabbis. It's not from the Torah. However, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, or Shimon ben Gamliel says, ksubas isha min haTorah. Ksubas isha is, in fact, from the Torah. Now the Gemara goes on a slight tangent. They challenge. They say, did Rishon ben Gamliel say this, that it's a Torah rule? V'atanya kezev yishkol kamo ha'besulos. We learned in a braisa that it says, the pasuk says, kezev yishkol kamo ha'besulos. The father collects money according to the price, literally the price, the value of besulos. She yezek kamo ha'besulos, kamo ha'besulos kezeh. And Rashi explains what this means. Rashi says, "Minatora b'kesef yishkol k'lakamon." Rashi says, "Kesef yishkol k'bimefatan emar." This was said by a case in the Torah that describes if a man seduces a girl, does he have to, and then sleeps with her, does he have to pay a certain amount, and how much does he have to pay, and so on? How much does he have to pay her father? So it says that the father collects kimor abesulos, and Rashi tells us kimor abesulos ha'amur b'ma'anis abesulos, which was stated elsewhere in the Torah by a case of rape. Kansu akasav nun kasef. The pasuk, the Torah, levied a fine of 50 silver coins. Bishvil mora besula, because of the value that she's now sort of devalued by virtue of her not being a virgin anymore. And the Torah tells us that these two things are equivalent, so to speak. That the 50 silver coins are the price that the rapist has to pay, and the price that the seducer has to pay as well. Mikan, the Gemara now goes on to say, Mikan samchu chacham l'ksubas ishim in haTorah. From here, did the rabbis see a hint to the idea of ksuba from the Torah? Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, ksubas isha ena midivrei Torah. A ksuba, a marital contract, is not actually from the Torah. Ela midivrei Sofrim. It's a derabanan enactment. Which would seem pretty clearly to indicate that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel never said that ksuba is d'oraisa. So the Gemara says epoch. Switch it around. This is a comment we find sometimes, that perhaps this braisa was told over wrongly. Really, it was supposed to be that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was the proponent of the first shita, that this idea of ksuba was hinted at in the Torah from Moab Basilos. That's his shita, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. And the chachamim, or some other opinion, the Tanakhama, whoever he is, was the proponent of the Shita, that it was actually Midrabanan. So the Gemara now asks, and this is where the back and forth of the Gemara gets somewhat fine, Umay Chazis de Ifachta Basraisa, and what did you see that motivated you to switch around the latter one that we quoted? We quoted two different statements, two different quotes. One was this Braisa that we just quoted, but one was also the earlier statement, the Idmar of Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel. So why did you switch the second around? Why not switch the first around? In Buch Kamaisa. So the Gemara answers, we heard elsewhere, we have another source, that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is the one who holds Ksubas Isha is Midaraisa. And therefore, the second brisa that we quoted is sort of the rogue brisa. Did not know we learned in the Mishnah, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel Omer. No zin lami maos kaputkia. He gives her from Maos Kaputkia. That the ex-husband has to give his ex-wife money of Kaputkia. And Kaputkia is a biblical coin. And therefore, if he's using that term, Maos Kaputkia, clearly it's something which indicates Ksuba is in fact Daraisa. So therefore we know that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel must be the proponent of the Ksuba Daraisa camp, and therefore whoever else we had quoted that said it was Daraisa, really we're going to say that was Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, and the other opinion that it was the Rabbanan is the non Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. And the Gemara gives another answer. Vibayisim, and if you want I will tell you another way we can answer the contradiction that we had earlier. Kula Rav Shimon ben Gamliel hi. Really the entire statement was Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, the Chasuri Mechzara. And there was a little bit lacking in the quote. It must be, we have to say that there was some words lacking. We're going to have to fill in those gaps ourselves. V'alfi katani, and this is how it's supposed to have been taught. Mikan sam chacham v'ksubas isha min ha-Torah. From here, the rabbis see a indication that there's supposed to be a ksuba from the Torah. Ksubas almana, however, the ksuba of a widow, eina midivrei Torah, ela midivrei Sofrim. Shimon ben Gamliel Omer Ksubas Almana Eina Midivrei Torah Ela Midivrei Sofrim. And really, that particular brisa that we quoted, that we originally thought was like a rogue brisa, was in fact entirely of Shimon ben Gamliel speaking. And it's saying Ksubas Daraisa. And now, which it mentioned that some Ksubas Darabanan really only meant some Ksubas, such as the Ksuba of widows. That's the Ksuba which is from the rabbis, but in fact, every Ksuba is Midaraisa when it comes to Besulos. The enactment itself of Ksuba was really from the Torah. Okay, now that we cleared up the Gemara, before we go on in the Gemara, which is going to discuss various other cases about instances where men came to various judges to claim Pesach Pesulach the day after their wedding, let's take a look at Tosfos Chazaka in Adam Toreach. This is talking about the Chazaka that we discussed earlier, which is the basis for Shmuel's opinion that a man is believed the day after his wedding to say Pesach Pesulach Matzasi, so much so that we would even cause her to lose out on her ksuba. Tosfos says Chazaka in Adam Toreach v'chulei Tema. Tosfos asks says it's a wonder. Tainach be'eshas kohen o b'pchusa migimol demitzer ala. It would make sense in a case where it's an eshas kohen, or where it's a girl who was engaged, who was betrothed, who had kedushin done at the age of under 3, and therefore there's going to be an isser when he says pesach pesulach matzasi. Hilkach, therefore, kivin demafsida, since he's going to be losing out as a result of making this claim, ne'aman, so then it would make sense that he's believed. Uvumand amar nami likaman, konsa becheskas besul of nintes v'ula, ein laksuba klal, nicha. Tahashtanami mafsida, shahari mekach tosu. According to the opinion later on, that if he marries her thinking she's a virgin and it turns out that she's not, she then gets no ksuba at all, so then our Gemara also makes sense. Because he's losing out by that which he's making this claim, because it's, we clearly view it as a mekach tos. Now, what exactly is Tosus bothered by? It seems that he has some kind of a question. He starts off by saying Tema. And he hasn't fully spelled it out yet, but I think we can get an idea based on what he's already told us. If you'll recall, we said on Tesamad Aleph that when a man comes in and makes a claim of Pesach Pesuach, it's a situation which, before he even opens his mouth, is what's known as a Sfeik Sfeika. Literally a doubt of a doubt. It means where there's the question in front of us sort of has two questions within it. And it's only if you answer each of those two questions in a particular way is there a resulting Isser. But if either of those two questions is answered differently, even regardless of the answer of the other one, there's no Isser at all. Let's say that the man who comes in is married, is himself a Yisrael. He's not a Kohen. So now we have two questions that need to be answered. Question one, was she mizana, which means did she commit adultery, which is the concern in this case? Did she do it while she was married to him? And did she do it willingly? These are two questions we have to ask. Because if she did it unwillingly, or if she did it before she was engaged to him, in either of those two cases, regardless, even if it's unwillingly while she was engaged to him, or before she was engaged to him, but willingly, in other words, in three out of four scenarios that could result from those two questions, there is no Isser whatsoever. Even though it may turn out, in fact, that she was not a virgin, and his claim is right, so to speak, and we believe him, nevertheless, there's no Isser. Because the Isser only results in cases where we have a single doubt. We have one doubt, we don't really know what happened, so then we say, because of that doubt, we're going to say it's Usser. We're unsure, and he's making claim, Usser. However, in the case of this fake faker, we have this sort of what we call in Hebrew Rov Tzadim, that most of the cases that we're discussing in this instance are going to result in a heter. Therefore, that means that he doesn't have believability to create an Isser on himself from sleeping with his current wife. This is what we said on Tesamad Aleph. Tosus is asking as follows. We suggested on Tesamad Aleph that the cases where he would be believed to say that she's Usser, if he makes such a claim, is if either he himself is a Kohen, and if he's a Kohen, it does not matter whether she was willing or not. It only matters whether she was committed adultery while she was married to him. And then we have one question. Did it happen while they were married or before they were married? Well, that one question is enough for us to say, let's be stringent, let's be machmir, and say that he's Aser. And we believe him to Aser himself to her. Or, if you have an instance where she was engaged under three, similarly there's only one doubt. Was it done willingly? Because if it was done before she was married to him, before she was even engaged, I should say, then we say that because she was less than three, the besulim, the hymen, would have returned, would have regrown. And therefore, if he did in fact marry her and then see that there was a Pesach Pesuach, it has to have been that she was Mizana, that she was with another man willingly. And therefore, there's only one question. When exactly did it happen? Well, how did it happen? Was it willingly or not? And therefore, because in each of these cases there's only a single doubt, therefore, we say that he's believed. So if he's in fact believed to create an Isra on himself, therefore, now in our case, where we're trying to figure out whether or not she's going to get a ksuba, well, we're trying to say that a person wouldn't make such a claim and then cause himself to lose out on everything and not be married to a wife unless in fact he was saying the truth. Well, guess what? If he's not going to be creating an Isser and he's going to be able to stay married to his wife, all he's going to do is make her lose out on her ksuba. And if he's going to make her lose out on her ksuba, then he's going to be able to stay married to her. There's no Isser. And therefore, this whole chazaka that we created, this whole assumption, a person wouldn't create a whole wedding feast and then lose out willingly, unless in fact he's telling the truth, doesn't apply. Because he's not losing out on the wedding feast. He's not losing out at all. He's going to stay married to his wife. All he's doing is gaining the fact that he doesn't have to give a ksuba later on if he ever chooses to divorce her. So now, here he tells us, it seems very clear. Tema says, it tells us it's a wonder. Tena fe'ishas kohen obib chuzo migimel. It makes sense if we're discussing the wife of a kohen, where again, the only way it could possibly be mutter is if it was before they got married. Obib chuzo migimel. Or she got engaged less than 3, where the only way it could be mutter is if she was with another man unwillingly. The mitzvah alei, where in that case, the single doubt creates an actual issur. Hilkach, kivin de mafsida, since he's in fact going to lose out, because now he's not going to be able to stay married to her, and we believe him. Ne'eman, and he's believed, therefore he's going to lose out. Therefore, this chazaka should be true. And therefore, in that case, it makes sense. Tosfos says, this halacha makes sense, and we can rely on this chazaka. And then Tosfos says, Ulamanda omar nami the kaman, konsa becheskas pesul of ninches beula in laksuba klal. According to the opinion later on that says that if a man married a woman thinking she was a virgin, it turns out she was not, she doesn't get any ksuba at all because of the fact that it's going to be looked at as what's called a mekach toz, a faulty sale, and therefore the sale gets undone and he's not able to stay married to her at that point. The hasha nami mafsida, that in that instance also he loses out, shaharei mekach tozu, because of the fact that we view it as a faulty sale and the sale gets undone and therefore there's no marriage here at all. And he's going to not be married to her in the future. Aval, however, Tosfos says, Lamanda Amar Yesh Lak Suba Mona. According to the opinion that she gets a ksuba of 100, that when it turns out that his assumption was wrong, that she was in fact a Ba'ula, not a Basula, she still can stay married to, he can stay married to her, I should say. However, her ksuba gets reduced from 200 to 100, which is the standard for non-virgins. Lo mafsid midi. He's not losing anything. All he's doing is gaining 100 later on if he ever chooses to divorce her. Ela shebala hafsid miksuba samana. He's coming to make her lose out from a ksuba 100 worth. Aval hasuda lo mafsid. He doesn't lose out on the wedding feast because guess what? They're still married. Va'amai mehemen, and why is he believed? And something that Tosfos does not spell out, but it bears mentioning, is the fact that this case of Ashes Kohen or Pchus Mibas Gimel, those cases where Tosfos did not have a question are the exception rather than the rule. The standard case is a case where a man is not a Kohen and he marries a woman after she has reached the age of 3. And therefore, in any case like that, according to this other man Amar, how can he ever be believed in the world of Shmuel? And Tosfos Vinir Dalo Mehemen. It appears that you have to say, it would be such a strange halacha to say such a thing if you're both in the world of Shmuel, that he's believed to make a Lizik Suba, and in this Manda Amar. It's hard to imagine. Therefore, it says they can't go together. You have to say that Manda Amar would not say you're believed. So just something interesting to point out, that the machlokas that we brought in of Shmuel and Rabbi Lazar, it seems like the Manda Amar of Shmuel is quite limited, because of the fact that he's unable to work in this other Manda Amar. Okay, just an interesting point in our Gemara, that the Chazaka of Inanam Torah Chesudim Afsida, that we sort of spoke as if it's a given, that perhaps there's an assumption that a person would never, psychologically we assume a person would never create a wedding feast and then lose out on it willingly. That assumption, although it may in theory be true, in practice it's almost never true, because the person isn't actually going to lose out halachically. Okay, let's take a look at the rest of the Gemara on this page. The Gemara says, we left off, the first word on the line is Ella. The Gemara says, Ahu da also the kameder Rav Nachman. That man who came in front of Rav Nachman, Amarle, and he said to him, Pesach Basurach Matsasi, that I found a Pesach Basurach. Amalei Rav Nachman, Azu Kofri. Rav Nachman said, we should beat him with reeds. In other words, give him Malkus. Mavrachta Chavitale. Rashi explains, what does this mean? Asvu Kofri, Rashi says, Hilkuhu Malkios B'Maklos Charios Sheldekel. Give him lashes with thin sticks, thin twigs from a date tree. Sheish ben oksin, which have thorns in them. Kimin kotsin, kedamrin and besuka. V'ima kufra durachaya darachina oksiv. We see from this Gemara and Sukkah that that's what that type of reed is like. And the Gemara then explains what Rav Nachman's reasoning was. Mavrachta chavitale. He sort of said it as almost a rhetorical question. And Rashi explains what that means. Zonos ha'ir hazos sheshma mavrachta, where the prostitutes of this city, which is known as mavrachta, chavutos v'shochos tamer the fun of always literally bending and lying down in front of him, liznus for adultery. Now that we see that he's some kind of an expert, in other words, who does he think he is that he really knows what he's talking about? Does he have so much experience that he should be able to realize? Presumably not. And therefore, Rav Nachman said he's really just lying and he's just making a false claim, and therefore, on the strength of that assumption, Rav Nachman felt comfortable even giving him malchus against what he was doing. So the Gemara questions, Vaharav Nachman hu da'amar mehemen. Didn't Rav Nachman say that he's believed? In other words, that we trust him if he comes in and says Pesach Pesuach, and in any instance, right? How does he have any experience? How does he know? So the Gemara says, Mehemen umasvinan lekovri. He's believed, and yet we give him lashes. Now, there seems to be some dispute amongst the later commentators how exactly to read this line, because to read it as a statement, as if it's giving some kind of an answer, is very strange. And others read it like this. Nehemen umasvinan lekovri. Is he believed and we give him lashes? And therefore, the Gemara then gives the following answer. Rav Achoy Mishani, Rav Achoy gave the answer, Kan Rebocher, Kan Benosli. One halacha of Rav Nachman where he's believed is by a married person who does in fact have reason to be somewhat knowledgeable. And one is by a bachar, a single person who we don't know why he would have any knowledge of any such things, and therefore we assume he's simply lying. Rashi explains, it's a Rashi that does not, at least in my edition, does not have any dibur maskal, no bolded words or anything. Bachar lo mehemen, a single person who was single before he got married, is not believed. And we whip him on that which he was brazen enough to make such a false claim. Nasui, a married person in heaven, would be believed. And of course we would not give him lashes. The Gemara now relates to another incident. That man who came in front of Rabbi Gamliel, Amarle, he said to him, Pesach Pesuach Matzasi, that I found the Pesach Pesuach. Amar Leis, so Rabbi Gamliel said to him, Shema Hitisa, perhaps you, we came into this before, maybe you literally leaned, maybe you were sort of directed off to one side without realizing it, and that was an idea of Atayah that we saw earlier around Daf Hei and Vav, Dalet as well. Em Shalach HaMashal, Rabbi Gamliel said to you, I'll give you a parable, L'mad Avedoma, to what is this idea compared, why would I have reason to sort of assume that you would have done Atoya? La'adam shahi mahalach b'ishan layla. A person who's walking in the darkness of the night, afela, and it's thick darkness. Hita, if he walks sort of at an angle, mitzal pasuach, he will then find the way he's going to be open. Lo hita, if he does not go at an angle, mitzal nal, he will find his way blocked. In other words, if you imagine a door that is very slightly ajar. Let's take a look at Rashi, who can do a better job explaining it than I can. Rashi says, Hita, if he goes at an angle, Kishihigia lepezach beso, when he reaches the door of his house, Hasagar, which is closed, V'yeshbo davar ma'akvo, and there's something which is blocking it from opening, Milaftoach, from opening, Ukshamatin asol et sudden, and when he moves it to the sides, Niftach, it opens. In other words, It's unclear what Rashi means. Either Rashi means that we're talking about like a sliding door, and if you can't push it forward, but you could slide it to one side or the other. Or perhaps what Rashi means is a door that's only slightly ajar, where if you walk straight ahead, it seems like the door is closed in front of you, and you can't move it because there's something behind it. But if you simply go at it at an angle, that slight opening, where it's just a little bit open, would be enough for him to go in. But it wouldn't be a direct entrance, it would be an entrance sort of at the side. And Rabbi Gamliel was saying, similarly here, the person was trying to bebowl his wife, was trying to be together, the way was blocked, and so sort of without even trying, he ended up doing this idea of Hataya, because that was the sort of the only place to go. Igeda Amri, others say, Halki Amarle. This is what Rabbi Gamliel's response was. Shema b'mezid hitisa. Perhaps you did Hataya on purpose. V'akarta l'dasha v'avra. And you uprooted the bolt and the latch of the door. Emshalacha mashal. I'll give you a parable. L'ma'ad avadoma. L'adam shum ha'chavishan l'adav ha'fe'el. A person is going in the thick darkness of night. Hita b'mezid mitzao pasuach. If he does Hataya on purpose, he'll find the door open. Similarly to our previous case where he went in an angle. Loita b'mezid, if he specifically chooses not to do Hatayah Mitzvah, no, he will find the door closed. And Rashi now explains, Ikud Amri, what was this other Ikud Amri, this other way of explaining Rabbi Gamliel's response? Below Misgavin, if one was not doing it on purpose, lo shkiach Hatayah, it's not common that Hatayah will occur. Velo Amri Nashem Ahita, we're not saying maybe you did Hatayah, Ela kach batku. He was questioning him, he was questioning him to see if he had actually done something wrong. Shema b'mezid hitisa. V'akarta l'dasha v'avra, which means akarta hadalas ha'briach, you uprooted the door and the bolt, meaning you specifically, actually the next Rashi says, hita b'mezid b'miskaving u'v'koach, on purpose and with force. Meaning if a door is, let's say, has a sort of some kind of a bolt that's holding it closed, if a person isn't aiming to open the door completely, but only to get it to be slightly ajar, it's possible to sort of, with force, cause that bolt to be slightly bent and give himself enough of an opening to get in. And he's not actually breaking the door down per se, he's just giving himself enough room to get in. Similarly here, Rabbi Gamliel was accusing the person, maybe you knew what you were doing, and you're doing this Hataya in order to be able to claim Pesach Pesuach the next day. So it seems that there's one of the common things we're seeing here is that the Dayanim, the judges, were not so quick to accept a claim of Pesach Pesuach because of the apparently the propensity of men to claim such a thing as a claim against their wives, and because of the fact that there was no reason that they should have knowledge enough to believe such a thing. Okay, the Gemara gives another example. Huda also the Kamei Dram Gomel. Excuse me. So the Gemara brings down one more incident. Hahu de Asa lekame de Rabbi Gamliel bar Rabbi, a person who came to Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi, Amar le Rabbi, he said to him, "My Rabbi, my master, ba'alti, I was together with my wife, v'lo matzal sidam, and I did not see any blood." So Amar lo, she said back to him, meaning the wife of this man, said to the judge, Rabbi, besula ha yisi. I was a virgin. I was never with anybody else before this. Amar lahem, he said to them, Hevi'u li oso suder. Bring me that, literally like a handkerchief, a piece of fabric, which is usually used as a way of indicating whether there was any blood or not. Hevi'u lo asuder. They brought him the handkerchief. V'sharu b'mayim, and he soaked it in water. V'chibsu, and they washed it. U'matza alav kamati b'damim. And they found upon it drops of blood. Amar lo, so he said to him, Lech zacha b'makekcha. Go and sort of be able to own your purchase. In other words, just a way of saying you have nothing to worry about, and there's your wife is perfectly mutter to you. Amar le huna mar bere derava mifarzakia l'ravashi. So Rav Huna, who is a Tana, said to who's an Amor, excuse me, said to Rava from Parzakia, excuse me, said to Ravashi, So anami ne'avid hachi. We should also do this. This is a method that we should employ when we have a shayla, that we should use this kind of cleansing process. Amale, so he said to him, Giyat shalanu kikibas shalahem. Giyat shalanu kikibas shalahem. That our laundry, our sort of good laundry, is like their regular laundry. In other words, the way we wash clothing in a unusual sort of, I don't know if it's dry cleaning, but you know, with more chemicals and the more advanced type of cleansing process, is the way they is just as good, is as effective as their regular laundry, the way they do laundry regularly. I guess this is in two different towns. The E-Amrit, and if you'll say, Niyabagiyat, so let's in fact do this more advanced cleaning process, Ma'abrele Chumrasa. It'll end up removing any stain that there was. In other words, since we have this advanced cleaning process, which Rashi tells us was done by rubbing with a rock against the cloth in order to remove any stains, that removed so many stains that it wouldn't be any kind of a verification process in terms of this halacha, and therefore we have no way of using their clarification process for such shilas. So it does, and just in general, the theme seems to be that the Rabbanim were not so quick to believe the grooms in these kinds of instances, and they used whatever sort of tricks or tools they could to come to clear truth of the matter, and not simply relying on rules that we had, Naaman or not Naaman. It was important to them to make sure that they knew exactly what the truth was. Let's hold it here for now, because we're already on to Yudam Beis, and we'll pick it up here when we begin next time. Have a good week, everyone.